The format of the meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Brandon.
My name is Brandon. I'm an alcoholic. I want to give a shout-out to Duncan and Gardner for allowing me this privilege. I got to give a shout-out to my former girlfriend, present wife, and my two boys that came down from Asbury. My sobriety date's July 29, 1988. I'm going to make this quick, 10-minute synopsis. One of 8 kids, Irish Catholic in the Bronx. There was a communion, a christening, or a confirmation going on sometime every year, every month it felt like. And my parents were first generation off the boat, and drinking was allowed, it was condoned, and they'd rather drink in the house than drink in the schoolyard. I grew up 3 houses away from the schoolyard. My older brothers broke me in. I was able to go into the schoolyard much earlier than my friends were because I had older brothers already there. And my life was great, and my life was what they say, fun, some fun, no fun. My first drink was 6 warm Miller Nips in the Oval, Williamsbridge Oval, and my boys dropped me on the front door of my house, and I was puking. And the only thing they told me was, I can't drink beer, switch to vodka. That was at 13 years old. There was a lot of things going on in my neighborhood. There was 100 or 200 kids running around, not like today, and it was a great time. Like I said, it was stickball, it was football, it was softball. There was so much to do. And on Friday night and Saturday night, we hung out in the schoolyard, we played our music, and we drank. And the parents condoned it. The police let us go, not like today. And I enjoyed my vodka. In the beginning, there was a lot of ice and a lot of orange juice. At the end, there was straight vodka. I liked high school so much, I stayed an extra year. And when I left high school, I crossed the invisible line. I was already a full-blown drunk. I was drinking every day, smoking weed on occasion, and my life was a shambles. I didn't know it, but my life was a shambles. June of 1983, I got a doorman's job down here. My neighbor was the building manager in one of the buildings. And I showed up 4 days a week, and be grateful that I showed up 4 days a week. The fifth day was recovering. There was no idea of what I was going to do when I graduated high school. I was going to go into the service. So June of 83, my mother passed away July of 84. And I had a pipe in my mouth having a good time that weekend. It was nuts. That's where my life was. My father passed away in 92, and it was all sober. I look at the dichotomy of that and how much AA saved my life. So July of 84 till September of 87, I was a raving lunatic. I drank up and down Bainbridge Avenue. There was 22 bars. Not one of them went out of business when I quit drinking. Not one. They talk about a threefold disease. I kept drinking, and the summer of 87, I had my threefold disease. I was in detox, the psych ward, and jail. That was my threefold disease. They talk about Christmas, Thanksgiving, and New Year's. Well, that was mine, the summer of 87. I came out of jail. I was on the subway. Two tall boys got a ticket. And I wound up in my first AA meeting Friday, September 12th, 1987. I walked into the acceptance group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Kevin Talty, not small T, but Talty, a lot of people know him, shook my hand. He was the first man to shake my hand. And I take this survey every time I share. I've never met anyone, so you got to answer this question. Does anyone walk into AA's first meeting happy? Not one of us. I've been here 31 years, and I stayed around long enough to get happy. I didn't want to be here. I was 22 years old. The last place I wanted to be was in an AA meeting. Excuse me, I have a cold. I did the marijuana maintenance program for 9 months. I would walk from my house. I'd watch Jeopardy every night at 7 o'clock. I'd walk across Marshall Loop Parkway, I'd get to my home group, Gun Hill, at 20 to 8, the meeting was over at 8 o'clock, and I wondered why I couldn't get sober. July of 88, I hit another bottom, and the men and women allowed me to stand on their shoulders at Gun Hill. They gave me a key to the place. They allowed me to make coffee. They allowed me to sweep up outside all the cigarette butts. I didn't have to. They let me. And I started getting sober. 5 minutes left. My sobriety from July of 88 till today has been skyrocket, straight up. 35 days sober, I went to Nashville for an Icky Paw. I was in Boston last month. The Icky Paws and the Paws of my life saved my life. A young guy, 22, 23 years old, got sober, and I was able to get involved with the Paws. Then I got involved with Sini, Southeast New York. I got involved with Bum, Bronx up in Manhattan. And I did service from being the chairperson of Bum to being the office manager of Sini to working on the Icky Paw in 94. My life was tremendous. Boy meets girl on AA campus. I met my former girlfriend on campus, and she's my plus one for the last 26 years. Me and her met on campus. We wound up living together. We wound up getting married. We wound up getting twins. And our service stopped. The service we did was changing diapers. The service we did was make sure those kids were healthy, and to make sure those kids did not have any problems. I grew up in a household that allowed drinking. My kids haven't seen me or my wife drink, 22 years old now. My life, I got a city job. I left a job with the plumbers. I went to work for the city. I went from $30 an hour to $12 an hour, but I know it was a safe place. I know I was going to get a pension at the end of it. So I've been there 25 years in July. I got 5 more years to go. And the city, it's kind of like the slackers of AA, if you want to be. Or you can be like the helpers. 90% of the people come to AA, 10% of the people do the work. That's what I've learned over the course of my time here. So my kids got a sober dad and a sober mom. My father passed away in 92. There was a line around the corner at the funeral parlor, all sober people. Monty, a lot of people know Monty. His mother passed away. We were laid out together. Everyone was going into both rooms. It was a tremendous, tremendous weekend. Before, the weekends were always, let's drink, let's get high. Now the weekends are, let's have a good time. Like Boston, up in Icky Paw. Icky, 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 pa, pa, pa. Saved my life. Continues to save my life. My home group saves my life. I'm still involved in my home group. I still make coffee. I still allow myself to clean up cigarette butts outside. And my home group meets 16 times a week. 167 Scarsdale Road, Bronx or Lasbury, the best group in AA. If you don't feel your group is the best group, don't come to my group and screw it up. Fix the one you're in. Because AA, there's a lot of different places that AA brings me. It brings me to a place that I'm safe no matter where I go. When I was on vacation, when I was drinking, I always knew where the bar was. Now me and my wife go on vacation, we know where the meetings are. Whether we make them or not, doesn't matter. We know where they are. And that's the thing we do. We have a sober household. You know, my wife, the cat cost us $1,300 today. I have that money. You know, he was in the vet for the last 2 days. Nothing really wrong with him. I think the vet needed a new vacation. That's what I think. But in general, I have these bills that come in, and they always come in. And no matter what, for the last 25 years, they've been paid. You know, we do what we're supposed to do. We stay sober. And what I've learned is the greatest thing I can do, the most responsible thing I can do, is the privilege of bringing someone through the steps. My sponsor brought me through the steps back in 88. I never had to do the fourth step again. I don't want to add to my 8-step list. You know, that's my trick. I got 1 minute left. I try not to add to my 8-step list. What I do is I continue to take personal inventory. When I'm wrong, I promptly admit it. You know, sobriety is a ride. If you're new or just coming back, please stay. We need you. There is a lot of people here. We need you as much as you need us. No one walks in here by accident. Nobody walks in here happy. No one says, I can't wait to get to an AA meeting. We get here by the skin of our teeth. And when we stay and we give it away and we watch that dead-eyed newcomer open up, that's our job. As a society, that's our job, to bring the newcomer into the life. Thank you for listening.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Stephanie.
Hello, everyone. I'm Stephanie. I'm an alcoholic. Wow. You guys look really beautiful out there. My sober date is August 16th of 2010, and my home group is the Empire Way Group of Seattle, Washington, so I'm visiting you all. And I just want to say right out front that speaking of IKIPAW, I came to this meeting when I came to IKIPAW in 2010. I had 12 days sober. All the normal people in my life thought I should... I'm guess apparently not close enough to this mic. thought I should stay home and regroup after my 100th relapse. And my sober family, my sponsor used to be an Atlanta Group member when she lived here, encouraged me to come to New York and do this thing. And I came to this meeting and I was absolutely blown out of the water. People knew that I wasn't from here. Welcome. Are you new? There's so many of you, but I actually felt welcomed. I was ashamed because I was relapsing a lot, as I mentioned, but being here that week was unbelievable, and I have not had the thought or the obsession to drink and use since then. And I want to credit the strong sobriety of this group. Just is really amazing, and I've gotten to experience a lot of that energy through my lineage and my sponsor. So thank you, and I want to welcome anyone who's here who's new. If you feel like you're new and you feel this won't work, I came at Alcoholics Anonymous in 2007 after my sixth treatment center. And I was a young mother, well, not really that young, I was 37. And I really believed that my problem was that I was crazy and that I had a moral failing. And that's why I couldn't stop drinking. The treatment center had told me on the first go-round, you need to go home, go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and find your people. And I didn't listen because I felt better. And a theme of my life since I've been a very young person is that I'm driven by my thoughts and my feelings and not by action. And I remember the first night I finally went to an AA meeting, I thought, God, there's no meetings near me. I don't know where to go. Mind you, I'd just been to treatment six times. Clearly, that was not the answer. So I looked at the schedule, which I had also never done, and there was a meeting two blocks away from my home. And I walked there, and I heard my sponsor, Thea C., speak. And I looked at her, and she had a calm demeanor, and she held herself with grace. And I believed her when she talked about her drinking. And I had heard people come into treatment and speak about alcoholism, and they were AA members that came in and did a service. But for some reason, that night, I was willing to talk to her after the meeting, and I was terrified. And I said, I need a temporary sponsor, because that's what they tell you to say in treatment. And she said, really, do you want a temporary sobriety? And... you know, and I don't even know if that's exactly what she said, but I was shocked, and I thought, oh, she doesn't like me, because I'm that sensitive, right? Something, when I began working the steps with her, I was told to read the big book with a pencil and a highlighter and write anything I wanted in the margins, what I identified with, what I thought wasn't true. And I thought, oh, great, because this book is really old, and it's probably not going to tell me anything I don't know, because with modern standards... as our previous speaker, Brendan, talked about, I came in here as a last option. I didn't understand it. There were happy people being really friendly to me, and it terrified me because I lived in the world of the self. And we began reading the book together after I completed that assignment. And we got to the part about the bedevilments. And when I read that, it just really described how I had lived my entire life, even as a young child. I didn't need a drink to feel that way. I grew up in an alcoholic home. My sister was an alcoholic and addict very young, and we had some things happen in our house that weren't appropriate for kids. And one of my favorite lines in one of the stories in the back of the book is, it's not what happened to me, it's how I reacted to what happened to me. And that's very true for my family. My sister ended up dying at the age of 26 of an overdose. And I remember it was the 80s or the early 90s, and no one had mentioned Alcoholics Anonymous for her with all of the struggles that we had as a family. And I never thought it would happen to me. After her death, I shut down, and I'll be the first to admit one of my character defects is that I had a huge chip on my shoulder because I was intelligent, and I thought, clearly I just won't do what she did, because self-will is the way to kind of motor through life. And I met someone, I got married, I had no idea what a real relationship looked like. One of my favorite lines in the 12 and 12 is, we couldn't have a true partnership with another human being, and that is one of the most true statements I've ever read. I had no idea how to be a human being. And, you know, this program, I thought I was coming to stop drinking. I had no idea, as Brendan just shared, the things that were available here. I'm just overwhelmed. I'm overwhelmed with what happens when you work the steps, when I work the steps. So I got married, as I said, and I developed a drinking problem beyond my control at 37, and I had no idea what to do. And I had a 6-year-old and a 3-year-old, and I loved them so much. And I remember, in an attempt to stop drinking, I would go into their room at night and stare at them and cry and say, I'm not going to go in the other room, and I'm not going to do those things that I do. I never told anyone, never asked for help. And we flip that to what happens when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, as willing to listen as the dying can be. And I finally worked the steps. I was in here for 4 years, never made it through a 4-step. Did the 90 and 90, had a service position, gave women rides to meetings. But I had never made it through 4. And once I did, and I did those amends, something happened. There's an old-timer in my meeting named Ralph B. and Dean. They always say, something happened. And I can't quantify what that is, but it's from taking direction that I don't understand or agree with. And it leads to this amazing thing. And so now I come to sobriety with being a sober mother of 2 young women who are 19 and 16. My daughter calls me from college and tells me what's really going on in her life, what she's doing. I don't tell her not to drink. I don't tell her to not do what I did. I'm there. I listen. I have experienced strength and hope. Her friends that might have a problem call me. Their parents call me. I have a working co-parent relationship with my ex, who may or may not be one of us, and it's very challenging. My God box has about 800 slips of paper in it right now. Probably should go to Al-Anon. I get to work with miraculous young women, and I've been able to see them get married, go to college, and have children, get off the streets, have a place to live. The human experience is what's available here, and it's so much more than I thought. That blue book and you guys were offering. And so I'm just unbelievably grateful. Again, that Ikipa that I came to, I remember there was a speaker that got sober young and started sharing. And afterwards, I went up, and I was so scared. She was really intense and super energetic and strong. And I said, I have 12 days, and my sibling died of an OD too. And she picked me up off the ground and swirled me around and said, keep coming back, kid. And she was way younger than me too, so I was kind of offended. But those are the kinds of things that I can't experience if I am not in line with a higher power and I'm not doing what you guys do. I can't do it on my own, and I'm so grateful that I finally surrendered to that fact. Thank you so much. I'm very grateful for the meeting to ask me to speak. Thank you.
Our main speaker tonight is Bob.
I'm Bob Darrell, I'm an alcoholic. from the hitting bottom capital of the world, Las Vegas, Nevada. And if you want to help drunks, it's a target-rich environment. And I have a sobriety date, and it's October 31st, 1978. And that's the date from which I've had no alcohol or anything else. And I have a home group. It's called the Connect the Dots Group. There's several members here tonight in Las Vegas. And if you come to that group, you'll know it's my home group by my actions. I have a sponsor who knows he's my sponsor. And if you have a sponsor who's not sure if they're your sponsor, they're not. I have commitments at my home group. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm an everyday member. Because I got every day, I got alcoholism. I want to welcome the new people. Glad you're here. I might be more glad you're here than you are. AA's weird. It's not. This is not like Amway. This is not like church. It's not like Anthony Robbins or, you know, it's different. It's the only organization on the planet where you come in a big shot, and if you're really fortunate, you'll work your way up to servant. Most places the other way around. And I've had alcoholism. Before I ever picked up a drink, I wasn't right. I didn't sit in the world the way other people seemed to sit in the world. There was something wasn't quite right about me. I couldn't explain it. I couldn't put my finger on it. I couldn't understand it. But I didn't feel the way all the kids I went to school looked. They all looked like they were connected. They all looked like they were a part of. They all looked like they had something I didn't have. And I was separate and apart from, almost as if there was some invisible yet impenetrable barrier between me and life itself. Bill Wilson refers to it as a state of anxious apartness. And I had that way before I ever picked up a drink. I must have been like a freeze-dried alcoholic waiting for alcohol. Because the first time I ever picked up a drink, I was almost 13 years old. It's like you don't even know that you don't really feel good until you really feel good. You know what I mean? I remember saying to myself, I want to feel like this the rest of my life. And I tried. I love the effect produced by alcohol. And I'm an alcoholic because alcohol does something for me that it only does for alcoholics. And it does something to me that it only does to alcoholics, regardless of what other problems you have. My God, I had a lot of other problems. I was diagnosed as a depressive. I had a diagnosis as an neurotic with free-floating anxiety and panic disorder. I had problems with substances other than alcohol. I had problems with relationships. I had problems with my family. I had problems with money. I had problems with employment. I had problems with what I think you're thinking about me. I have a lot of problems, but what makes me an alcoholic is that when I found alcohol, I found the first and most significant and immediate treatment for all the crap that was wrong with me. And I remember the early days of drinking, it's spectacular because alcohol does something for me that I can't get anywhere else on the planet. And what it does is it relieves me of this bondage of self and allows me to come out and play. It allows me to be funny because I'm not funny sober, I'm a mope. It allows me to talk to girls. I can't talk to girls. It allows me to dance. You get me half drunk, the rhythm of the universe flows through me. I can dance. It allows me to play guitar and sing and play in bands and do things I can't do on the natch. I remember times I'd get half drunk because I never stay half drunk. I always get drunk. But on the way to drunk, there's a little zone there that, oh, my God. Get in that zone, everything clicks, can't miss. I'd be hanging out with these other juvenile delinquents down at this pool hall. I'd get in that zone. Man, I couldn't miss. I'd blow my own mind with the shots I was making. I could be deep, and it was like I got more intelligent and more creative and deeper. You ever had the experience at 3 o'clock in the morning? drinking wine, maybe smoking a little reefer, cracking the secrets of the universe, you know, just with your buddies. I remember saying to my friends one time, this is what Buddha saw. You know, you see the big picture. And then you know what happens? You get sober and you're back to being you again. And I never liked that much, but I loved what alcohol did for me. And I needed to have it done. And I yearned to have it done. And I lived to have it done. But alcoholism's a progressive disease. And what that looked like in my life experientially, as time went on, my ability to get free when I drank started getting a little iffy. And the fun and the freedom and the amazing feeling started bleeding out. And I don't know what's happening to me. And I don't know why now sometimes at the end, the last 3-4 years, I'd drink and I'm not the life of the party anymore. So the last couple years, I drank in depression. I drank in horrible, horrible feelings of loneliness that at 3 o'clock in the morning would drive me to get on the telephone and call up people I went to grade school with. And, you know, I called an ex-girlfriend about 4:30 a.m. one time. The minute she got on the phone, I heard her voice. I started crying into the phone. We should have got married. And then her husband gets on the phone, threatens me. This is not a party. And yet you get me sober 6 months, and something happens to me that always, always, always drives me back to picking up that first drink. And the problem with that is that alcohol does something to me that it only does to alcoholics. And I know we get a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous now. They're confused because they do all kinds of substances. There's only one. You know, drug and treatment centers ask you stupid questions like, what's your drug of choice? Well, you can't ask me that because I'll pretty much say, well, what do you got? I mean, you know, I'll try anything in a pinch. What they should ask me is, what happens to you when you drink alcohol, Bob? Could you pass the test in the book? And there's that test is, go over to the nearest bar room. Try to drink and then stop abruptly. Can you pass that test? Well, I couldn't pass that test. And I don't know I can't pass that test because I think I could pass that test if I really wanted to pass that test. And what happens to me if I were to go there, I remember one time my job was threatened if I had smelled like alcohol ever again on this job, and I needed this job because I need that paycheck, because without that paycheck, there's no medicine. And I need to drink every day. And I go to this bar because I'm nervous. My nerves are shot. And I'm just going to have 2 drinks. That's it. 2 double vodkas because you can't smell vodka. I'm going to put a little orange juice in it, make it a health drink. And then I'm going to go back to work. Well, I'm committed to just 2 and go back to work. I'm committed to that. But I don't know I have alcoholism. So I go into the bar and I get first screwdriver dealt with double shot of vodka, and I throw that down. I didn't mean to. I was going to sip it. I couldn't sip it. Threw it down. Now I've got 1 left, and I start sipping on that. And I'm starting to think, this is the damn United States of America, for God's sakes. Who are they to tell me I can't drive? I don't do anything wrong at work. I don't get in fights with anybody. I said to the bartender, I said, do I look drunk? And I walked up and down in front of him in the bar. And he said, no, you look fine to me. Give me another drink. And I don't know that that's an abnormal reaction to alcohol, because this allergic reaction to alcohol that creates a phenomenon of craving uses my own mind against me. I don't think it's a craving. I think I changed my mind. And this disease punked me out over and over and over and over again. And I don't know what's happening to me. And the other aspect of alcoholism that makes it chronic, and I have known acute alcoholics. And they're not cute, but it's acute. And acute alcoholics have serious, serious drinking problems. But when they make up their mind, and it talks about this in the book, If a severe enough reason, ill health, the judge, the wife, the husband, whatever, they'll come to their senses and they'll go, my God, I can't keep doing this. I'm ruining my life. And they'll stop drinking. They might need to go to detox, but they'll stop drinking and they'd never go back. But they don't have, their problem stops where the bag in the bottle ends. My alcoholism really starts where the bottle ends. And that's what I couldn't get my mind around. And that's just about what killed me, because I didn't understand it. I thought once after, I came to my first meeting before I was, wasn't even old enough, I was a teenager, I wasn't even old enough to take a legal drink. And I was in a treatment center. And the first couple treatment centers I was in, I kept telling myself I wasn't an alcoholic. And then I finally understood that I have that thing that if I pick up a drink, when the effect of alcohol hits me, I can't stop. I finally got that. And I got that out of failure to control and enjoy my drinking. And I thought I was out of the woods. I thought, oh my God, now that I have the knowledge coupled with, I'm tired of this. I'm tired of ruining my life. I thought, now that I have the knowledge that I must never drink again and the determination, I'll tell you, I thought I was out of the woods. Little did I know I was entering into the most horrific, disgusting, and painful years of my life, armed with the information that I can't take the first drink, swearing to myself, sometimes sobbing as I'm doing it, that I'll never pick up another drink, and I always went back to it because of a disease called alcoholism, and I am chronic. The physical stabilization of my sickness is not the answer. It's the beginning of a lifetime treatment, just like the diabetic. Stabilizing the diabetic's blood sugar is just the beginning. And stabilizing, getting me physically sober is just the beginning. And I didn't know it. And it's killing me because I get sober and I want to stay sober. But I start getting weird. I don't know that I'm weird. You know what it looks like? I'm not really weird, but my God, you are. Oh, everywhere I look, I see stupid people everywhere I look. Grocery store, on job, stupid people there. Traffic, stupid people in traffic. Then you go to these AA meetings, they got the frickin' stupid people grouped here. And I don't understand. I think, because I'm dying from an ego disorder. I fit the old adage, you can always tell an alcoholic, you just can't tell him much, right? I had a great psychiatrist back in the mid-70s, Abe Torsky. He's a legend around Pittsburgh. He's written books. He's devoted his life to us, and he's not an alcoholic. And he cornered me after the third institution I was in where he lectured, and he cornered me, and he said to me, he said, kid, guys like you don't get any better. He said, you don't get any better is because even though you have no self-esteem, and I don't know how he knew that. He said, even though you have no self-esteem, you've grown this gigantic ego, and because of that, you're absolutely incapable of listening to anyone in order to hear anything new. You're only capable of listening to see how you're already right. And I thought, what a stupid old man. Right? And that was the most accurate diagnosis of me. And I went to a lot of psychiatrists. That was the most accurate one. And I didn't know that I was dying of this bondage of self. No wonder that every time I get sober, I feel so disconnected. I even in AA meetings, and before I started working the steps and sponsoring people, I'd sit in meetings with a feeling like it's all of you. And then there's me. And here's the kind of guy I am. If I don't feel like I fit, you can bet I'm going to make it your fault. You're clicky. That's what you are. You're stuck up. That's what you are. I'll make it your fault. I'm the guy who can ruin my life, and I will make it somebody else's fault. I blame my parents for everything. And all my parents ever did was love me. They sacrificed for me. They spent a fortune on me, psychiatrists and treatment centers and bail bondsmen. And I destroyed them. I gutted them emotionally over and over and over again. One of the worst things I did to my mother and father was I'd get back up on my feet again. And because they loved me, they would get their hopes up for me. And then just about the time they'd start to, they would feel like they didn't have to walk on eggshells anymore. Just about the time they could breathe easy, that's the time. I'll go on a run and I'll rob them and I'll lie to them and I'll disappoint them and I'll gut them emotionally one more time. And that was the worst thing I did to them, as I kept getting back up on my feet, getting their hopes back up just to smash it down again. And I did that to them for years until they couldn't handle it anymore. They were losing their minds and they were good people. And so they physically cut me out of their life. But according to my sister, they couldn't cut me out of their heart. So my dad slept 15 hours a day, and my mother, who was a therapist, was now seeing her own therapist and taking medication. And I walked around telling everybody, I don't hurt anybody except myself. Is there a more selfish perception than that? A more inconsiderate, selfish? And one of the worst, my dad, I stole so much from them. My dad became friends with the guy who owned the pawn shop in the town we lived in from buying his own crap back. The last couple years of my sobriety, they never left the house. And they had once been, they were very social, they were very altruistic people, they were good people. They used to get involved in charity drives. My mother was women's club, junior league. My father had been president of the Lions Club, the country club, and they were just community people. They went to church. Last 2-3 years, I drank. They never left the house because they were just tired. They couldn't face people asking them about me anymore. They couldn't take it. And I walked around saying, I don't hurt anybody except myself. Wow. 1978. 1977 was an interesting year. 1977, I went to jail a lot. 1977, I stabbed my only friend left through the lung and almost went to prison forever through a series of circumstances. I just finally, after 35 years, I found that guy and made amends to him. 77 was a bad year. I remember one time in 77, I ended up in a emergency room again. I end up in emergency rooms a lot because when I get drunk, stupid drunk, I do things that hurt myself sometimes. I have this habit of getting in, just becoming really tough and getting in fights in bars. But by the time I get tough and want to get in the fight, I've lost all my coordination, right? Bad deal. That's a bad deal. And sometimes in a rage because I hate what I've become and I hate what I'm doing, I'll put my fist through a window. This particular time I did that and couldn't stop bleeding. So they took me. Some people took me to the hospital, and they stitched me up, and they gave me X-rays. And I'm sitting in the waiting room because I got to wait for the results of the X-rays. Right, I'm sitting there in the waiting room, the emergency room. They got a rack of pamphlets there, like heart disease, diabetes, you know, that kind of stuff, medical pamphlets. There was one that was talking, it said something like the 7 warning signs of cancer. And I grabbed it, and I'm just like thumbing through it. And there was, one of the symptoms of cancer was intermittent, unexplained bleeding. And I'm looking at that, and I'm thinking, oh, you know, I throw up blood some mornings when I get to dry heaves. Oh, wait a minute, you know, there have been a couple times I'm bleeding out of both ends. I thought, oh my God, I got terminal cancer. And then I had this epiphany. I thought, oh, wait. It's metastasized into a brain tumor. That's why I do the bizarre things and don't remember them. That's why I fly off the handle on jobs for people with no apparent reason. That's why I get withdrawn sometimes, almost comatose. I got a brain tumor. I thought I was a bad guy of a brain tumor. And I liked the idea. I would fondle the idea of the brain tumor. I'd fondle the idea of, you know, the day will come when I'm, they find out, they're going to take me to a cancer ward, I'm sure, and they're going to have to notify my mother and father, who will have nothing to do with me because they think I'm a bum, and they're going to realize how wrong they had been. And then, of course, all my ex-girlfriends are going to be notified, and they'll come running to the hospital properly ashamed of themselves. And, oh, I loved the brain tumor. And then I ended up in another detox, and medical guys interviewing me. You know how they do? They test your vitals and everything. And I said, he's talking about alcoholism. I said, Doc, I got a terminal brain tumor. He looks at me, and he rears back. He goes, has that been verified? I said, yes, it has. Well, it was verified by the smartest guy on the planet, me, right? And he gave me a whole bunch of tests. They stuck me in a tube. They stuck dye in me. They did all kinds of stuff. And I'm waiting for my redemption where everybody's going to, I may be dying, but everybody's going to realize that they were wrong about me. And they called me in for my redemption. He says, you don't have a brain tumor. Matter of fact, you don't have any cancer at all. All we could find was a small ulcer and a small hemorrhoid. I thought, I wanted another opinion. I mean, this is, you know, he was happy, like it was good news. You're not going to die. You don't have cancer. I'm depressed, right? Because I am so egocentric that my ego doesn't care if I'm going to die as long as after I'm dead, everybody realizes I was right. Right? And that following year, I ended up thrown out of a place that I was put in by the courts, and I was going to go to prison for 2 years. And I don't want to go to prison. I don't jail well. And I'm sitting in the park, and I don't know how many days on this run I've been in the park, and I'm sick. I am sick. I'm getting these sores again that I've had before that don't heal because I don't eat. My gums are bleeding. I shake like an old burnout wino. I'm a mess. I hate myself. I can't get high anymore. I drink, and I drink in depression. It's horrible. And I remembered what that doctor said. The last thing he said to me after he gave me the results that I didn't have cancer, he said, kid, what you have is alcoholism. And if you keep drinking, it's going to kill you. But you're a young kid. I was in my 20s. He said, might take 5 years before it kills you. And that morning in that park, I thought about 5 more years. And something inside me just snapped. I thought, my God, I can't do 5 more days of this. Because I am in a trap I can't spring, where drinking has become horrible and pathetic and depressing. And abstinence is kind of the same, because abstinence feels like I'm doing time. And I'm restless, I'm irritable, I'm discontent, I have low-level depression, sometimes not so low. I'm full of anxiety, I have a head that just gets on me when I sober up and won't leave me alone. And I think, I'm stuck in a trap I can't spring. And so I made the decision to kill myself, and I couldn't do it because I'm a coward. Went to a bridge to do it, couldn't do it. And through a bizarre series of circumstances, I ended up in a detox 2,000 miles away, running from the law. I couldn't run no more. I was too sick, and I ended up in this detox, and I got a sponsor in that detox. I did something I never did before. I went up to a man and I said, would you sponsor me? And if you will, I will do anything you ask me to do. And evidently I meant it, because when he started putting my feet to the fire and telling me to take directions, like turn myself in and offer to do the 2 years, I followed his directions, even though I didn't want to. And I got involved in Alcoholics Anonymous in every aspect of service, intergroup, general service. I've had a minimum of 2, sometimes 3 or 4 hospital and institution commitments every week for over 40 years. That's one of the things I love about my home group. We do over a dozen or more of those panels every week. And I started to get involved. I started sponsoring people. And I'll tell you this story and I'll end. When I was about 9 or 10 years sober, I went out of town for one of the first times I ever went. I was asked to come somewhere and speak, and it was like a real honor. It blew my mind. And I was going up to Northern California, a place called Eureka. And I'd never been there. And I went up there and I had a whole day to sightsee. And this guy's my host and he's taking me around in his pickup truck. And we go to this place called the Avenue of the Giants. And it's this redwood forest. And I had never seen anything like it. There was trees there that were like 20 feet or more in diameter, 200, 250 feet high. It was like walking into a scene of Jurassic Park or something. It was amazing. We spent some time there, and the guy said, come on, I want to take you down to the coast where there's these cliffs and these rock monoliths that come out of the ocean. I said, okay. I get in the truck with him. We're driving along. It's a little ways to go, and we're passing these meadows and fields. And he said, do you notice how you don't see a 200-foot tree all by itself in the middle of a field? I said, yeah. He said, you know why that is? I said, no, I don't know. He said, well, God has designed them in such a manner that they cannot help but to aspire to such magnificent heights that alone they will literally outgrow their roots' capacity to support them, and they will topple over and die on their own aspired magnificence. What has to happen is that they must grow up in community and they will intertwine their roots with the other trees into a net below the floor of the forest, and they'll feed each other and support each other and hold each other up, and that allows them to grow into their nature. And I thought, my God, isn't that what I found here? I didn't know it when I got here. I didn't know it by doing service commitments and sponsoring people and being part of a home group. I didn't know that I was intertwining the very roots of my life with yours. And you did something for me that alone I had something wrong with me that I could not overcome. And that is I got this thing inside me that I just yearn for more. I mean, I yearn for, I'm a more kind of guy. What do you, more of what? I don't know. What do you got? I mean, you know, I just want more. And it almost killed me. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I intertwined my life with yours with a purpose of to start wanting what God wants rather than what I want. Our book, both our books says it's the proper use of the will is to align my will with God's. And isn't that odd that I would even stand here and say that? Because when I got here, I was an atheist. I mean, I wasn't really a true atheist. I've known some true atheists. You have to be very religious about your atheism and be a good atheist. I wasn't that guy. I was a guy who was afraid of God. I was a guy who just, if I suspected you didn't like me, I'm going to not like you first. And I'm a guy that rejected God because I was afraid he would reject me. And you people in Alcoholics Anonymous told me, we don't care. We don't care how you feel. We don't care what you believe. We care what you do. And Alcoholics Anonymous is accused sometimes of being a faith-based program. It is not. Sometimes it's accused of being a feelings program. It's really not that. It's an action program. I take actions I don't believe in that are given to me by old-timers in Alcoholics Anonymous that I am convinced are not going to work. And then I get my mind blown as I realize how wrong I'd been again. And isn't that what happens here? I grow spiritually. I get this horrible ego disorder. And that's one of the great things about the resentment part of the inventory is I listed all my judgments and then did what it talks about on page 66 and 67. When I made those realizations and I looked at it from an entirely different angle, I started to see how wrong I'd been about my mother as I looked at my childhood through their eyes, how wrong I'd been about my exes, about the bosses. I started to maybe see a glimpse of the people I hated the way that God sees them. And I started to get free. And this is, we don't grow, and I started to realize how wrong I was. We don't grow here by being right, I'm telling you. We grow here by our willingness to be surrendered and be wrong. And if that wasn't true, you can bet that somewhere in our literature it'd say, and when we were right, We promptly admitted it. Thanks for listening.